It was cold that night. The fire cut the bone-aching chill of the damp air, but it could not cut the heart-aching chill of my regret at the words I had just spoken. "I am not," I said to the busybody girl who was on guard duty. Yet her words were knives. "You are not one of his disciples, are you?" she whined. Twice more that sorry and beleaguered night, I would deny my earlier declaration of him. Twice more I would hate myself for the words which hoisted the flag of my cowardice. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Thank you all for coming this morning. It's wonderful to be at home here in Capernaum again and to be in this little tavern at the edge of the sea. Why, I see some of you with whom I've been lifelong friends and others that have been my colleagues in the fishing business for many years. Thank you for taking the time after a long night of fishing to have some of this hot, hearty tea with me for a few moments. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Peter. My words were too quickly spoken that night, and people do tell me that I am much too impulsive. But being impulsive is not as bad as you may think. You have to be impulsive to be a good fisherman. You have to know your job is to get out there with your boats and let down your nets. Fishing requires quick decisions. Now, Andrew, my brother, he's a bit more the thoughtful type. He'll think long and hard about the best place to cast out the nets. Now, don't get me wrong. That's all good enough. We all need those types, too, in this business. But I don't know too many good fishermen who sit back and reflect for a whole lot on the deep meaning of catching fish. You just go after them. And so I'm not reluctant to say that I am the go-getter type. But Jesus let me have it every now and then for being so quick on the draw. I admit, in the garden outside of Jerusalem, when they came to get Jesus and I pulled my sword on that snotty servant to the high priest, I agree that cutting off his ear probably didn't serve the cause of peace and harmony. And Jesus called me down pretty good on that one, too. And then there was the time right after he fed 5,000 men plus women and children, and he told us to take a boat and go over to the other side of the lake, and that squall came up. Well, I've grown up here on the Sea of Galilee, as many of you have, and I know how those storms can swoop out of the hills from the north and come through the lake with ferociousness and be gone as quickly as they came. So I didn't feel too worried. But then you remember that Jesus bid me to come and walk out on the water with him where he was walking. You do know, don't you, that my name Peter means rock. Well, that night I sank like one. I know sometimes I think too little and speak too quickly. Do you remember the time that Jesus took John and James and me up on the hillside? Why, I thought we were going to get a little seminar on prayer. But all of a sudden, this white light comes out of the sky, practically blinding me. And then Moses and Elijah appear. And Jesus is conducting a conversation with them about what is going to happen to him when he comes to Jerusalem. Oh, I should have kept my mouth shut. But you know, sometimes you just feel awkward and you have to say something. So I asked if they wanted me to put up three tents, one for each of them, just in case it rained. Well, I got put in my place pretty good. This voice comes out of heaven telling me to be quiet and listen. Okay, I need to listen more. But sometimes, like I said, it's better to act quickly. You know, the first time I saw Jesus was right out here on the shore by the boats in Capernaum. Andrew and I were casting for a shallow catch. The nets were heavy, and when Jesus said, "Follow me," I didn't say to where. I guess I didn't feel much like being a fisherman that day. And when Christ says, follow him, you don't ask any questions. It's not the time for an examination of the syntax of his words. You just do what he says. Like the time we were in the desolate spot with a group of 4,000 people. I mean, they had been there for about 36 hours listening to Jesus teach. And some of the disciples were a bit more organized than I was and thought it might be a good idea to send the folks home so that they could get something to eat. But Jesus told us to feed all 4,000 of them using 7 loaves of bread and 2 fish brought by a young boy for his lunch. Oh, he's amazing, all right, this Jesus. And then there was the time that I did return to my fishing trade for a while. We were washing our nets one morning after not catching all night. Jesus came walking along the shoreline with a huge crowd in tow. He asked if he could use one of my boats to push out from the shore just a bit so he could get a better vantage point to speak to the crowds. And then after the sermon, he told me to put out into the deep water and let down my nets for a catch. Well, I tried telling him I had worked hard all night and there was not anything to be caught. I almost suggested that he stick to preaching and let me do the fishing. But I thought better of it and let down my nets. I caught so many fish in the next 2 minutes that my nets began to break. You know, I think that was the first time that I really began to know who Jesus really was. Sometimes I am too quick to come to conclusions, but I was right about him. One time up on Caesarea Philippi, way up in the north, he asked the people who they thought he was. Some of the guys had got into a lot of speculation in their answers. They thought maybe he was Elijah or Jeremiah or one of the prophets who'd come back for a return engagement. But I told them flat out, you're the Messiah, the Christ, the Holy One of God. And he told me flesh and blood didn't reveal that to me. In other words, I didn't figure it out by myself, but it was God who showed me from the inside out who he was. But I guess even then I didn't know very much about what it meant for him to be the Christ. When he started saying that being the Messiah meant he was going to go to Jerusalem and be pushed around by the elders and the scribes and the Pharisees and then be killed, well, I couldn't stand the thought. And I told him so, and that's when he told me, Peter, the way up is the way down. If you're going to save your life, you'll lose it. So Jesus was going to go to Jerusalem to lose his life. But it was going to be given back to him. We didn't understand that then. You know, I guess it's a part of my impulsiveness that I use the word never a lot. Problem is, I have to eat that word a lot too. I told him he would never suffer at the hands of the religious leaders in Jerusalem. I told him he would never wash my feet like some kind of servant. I told him I would never deny him. You know, telling that bunch in the high priest's courtyard as I warmed my hands around the fire, telling them that I never knew him, well, I am a coward. A likable, impulsive coward. But a coward, nonetheless. And so I admit that impulsiveness is a mixed blessing. You know what a guy like me needs? He needs an anchor for his soul. If you put one of my boats out there in the middle of the sea and a storm comes up and the boat isn't anchored securely in the right way, the wind and the waves will just push that boat toward the shore and beat it against the rocks until it falls into 10,000 pieces. Well, I'm like that. I need an anchor. That's why I followed him. He gave me that kind of mooring. I've been a leader all my life, and I've made a mess of it more often than not. And in the midst of the wild extremes of my life, Jesus became a stable point. I suppose you'd say he gave me a kind of peace. Not the kind of peace that you have when you're up in the hills overlooking the sea above us here in Capernaum, and things are calm and beautiful. Not that kind of peace. More like a peace that is associated with cleanness rather than calmness. Sometimes when I saw him heal somebody or create fish in nets where the fish weren't a moment before, Sometimes I would feel very unclean because I realized that I was dealing with someone whose power was connected to his perfection. He was so clean, and I am so dirty. And so when that bratty little girl outside the priest's courtyard asked me if I was one of his disciples, and I said no, my soul was filled with darkness and anguish. When I said I didn't know Jesus, I really was at sea in the midst of a storm with no moorings. When I traded him for a warm fire in that courtyard that night, ferocious darkness flooded into my own heart. I felt angry and hurt and stupid at the same time. A fisherman does not throw his anchor overboard in the midst of a storm. But that's what I had done. My boat was headed for the rocks, and I knew it. The next day, after a pretty flimsy trial with some trumped-up witnesses and accusations, Pilate turned Jesus over to the will of the mob who had been manipulated by our Jewish leaders. By noon, they had him run out of town and had him hanging, gasping for air on a cross. As I watched from my cowardly distance, I realized something. I realized that there on that cross, Jesus was the one who was on the rocks. He was the one who no longer had his anchor. He was the one who had given up the moorings of his soul. He screamed out just before he died, "My God, why have you forsaken me?" His anchor was gone. I found Andrew and John and the others, and we spent the next couple of days in a kind of stunned stupor. We half-heartedly started making our plans to head back home for various parts of Galilee. When the first day of the week came, it was time to pick up the pieces and get back to fishing. Andrew and I were talking over how we might get our old crew back together and buy back some of our old boats. We were just about ready to pick up and start heading for Jericho, the first leg of the journey north, when in bursts Mary Magdalene. My heart ached for her because she loved Jesus so much, and these last days had been filled with so much mourning and sadness. But she was excited and nervous and clearly upset. She said that she had been out to the tomb of Jesus early in the morning before the sun came up in order to anoint his body with the burial spices she hadn't had time to do at the beginning of the Sabbath. And her words spilled out, "They have taken the Lord out of the tomb, and we don't know where they have put him." I felt that bitter hatred rising again in my gut against the Romans and the Sanhedrin. It wasn't enough for them to kill Jesus. It wasn't enough for them to crucify him like he was a murderer. It wasn't enough for them to take away the only sure anchor Israel ever had. But now they had to steal his body, fearful we might make off with it. Well, I said I was impulsive, right? Well, I jumped up, running as fast as I could toward the tomb. I guess John must have been pretty impulsive as well, because he was running even faster than I was, and he got there first. When I arrived a minute or so after him, he was peering down, looking in the tomb. Well, I didn't wait around for anybody to give me a lecture on decorum at tombs. I just went right in. The linen cloth in which he had been hastily wrapped was lying there. I could see from the blood on it where the wounds from his hands and his side had seeped through. I remembered the line from the prophet somewhere who said that the servant who would suffer would be marred and scarred and would not have the kind of appearance that men would want to look upon. And I was lost for a moment looking at that blood-stained cloth. I couldn't get out of my mind the picture of those wounds. But then I stopped. And suddenly I realized what wasn't there. Jesus wasn't there. And somewhere between my head and my heart, I remembered his words. I turned to John, who entered the tomb after me, and I said, "Do you remember, John, what he said? You will all fall away because of me. The shepherd will be struck down and the sheep will be scattered. But then he said this, John, after I have been raised, I will go before you into Galilee. Now I want to ask you something here this morning, my friends. Do you think God was tricked on that garbage dump outside of Jerusalem? Do you think that what happened to Jesus was just the tragic consequences of inept and corrupt religious and political leadership? Well, I'm no elder and I'm no scribe, but I want to tell you something that I do know. Men did the worst they could do to Jesus, and then God did the best he could do to Jesus. God put an end to the agony of death by raising Jesus to life. It was impossible for him to be held in death's power. All the bitterness and hatred of men's fury was poured out on Christ. But God gave power to the death that men produce. And where there was only the meanness of death, God turned it into a living hope by bringing Jesus out of the tomb. Do you know what we all have done? We have all thrown our anchors overboard. And all of us, every one of us, is running our boats into the rocks. When Jesus died, not only the anchor of my soul, but the anchor of the whole world was cast into the deepest sea, so deep and so far out of reach that it could never be retrieved by men. And without that anchor, the world heads for the rocks of its own destruction, be it by death or warfare or the petty battles of everyday life. The rocks of death destroy everyone without that anchor. We fool ourselves a lot, you know. We try and make ourselves believe that the storm will not come to us. We think we can glide calmly across the water of our lives. But you know as well as I do that storms do come, and how quickly they can come, and how quickly we can lose control without an anchor. And without an anchor, my boat is heading for the rocks. The agony of death holds its invincible power on every one of us. No one will be spared the death rocks unless he gets an anchor that will hold them back from those rocks, that will prevent the boat of his life from smashing upon them. Do you see the rocks? Do you see how sharp and dangerous they are? Do you see that you don't have an anchor anymore? You threw it overboard. Do you know how big and wide and deep is the love of God? When you threw over the only anchor that would save you, God gave it back. God has taken the boat of your life and in the midst of the ferociousness of the storm has anchored it securely and safely. Your anchor has been given back. He is not dead. He is not dead. He is alive. He holds your boat from the rocks. The anchor is the rock who saves you from the rocks of death. He holds your life until the storms are past and you can safely steer to shore. He commands my boat. He is my captain. He is even more powerful in his living again. He steers me away from the rocks. He is the bleeding galley slave who has become the captain of my soul. And not only of my soul, he is the world's captain. The anchor of my soul is the anchor of the world. This small and fragile earth itself is heading for the rocks of destruction. But the dying servant has become the living captain. Those same hands which nails stabbed now hold the tiller of this poor world. The ugly wounds of suffering are now the handsome tokens of His splendid leadership. He shall ever be the captain of the universe, and at the step of His pierced feet and at the nod of His bloodied brow, the storm shall cease forever. And the greedy rocks of death shall dash to death their prey no more. I find it amusing, as I told you before, that my name, Peter, means rock. As a sailor and a fisherman, I've always been wary of the rocks. But now I see the twist in Jesus' meaning. Left to myself, I either sink like a rock or I am dashed on the death rocks that endanger us all. But here's the twist. Jesus named me rock because my declaration of faith in Him is a rock. I'm impulsive, unreliable, even dangerous, like the rocks on the seacoast. But Jesus makes my trust of Him a rock He can build on. And He wants the same declaration of trust from all of you here this morning, gathered in this cozy tavern. He wants you to know that your lives will end on the rocks of death, or they will be built upon the rock of His life-saving power. I remember that He told me that upon the rock of my declaration of faith in Him, He would build what He called the church. I'm not sure I understand all that, what the church is, but He said that Hades gates would not overcome it. And that part I do understand. He is the captain of my boat. He steers it away from hell's destruction. The jagged rocks of death crushed Him. But God has made Him to be an anchor and a captain, ever to live and ever to help those of us who put our lives in His nail-marked hands, who build our lives upon the rock of faith that Christ is not dead. He is alive by the power of God. And with Him too, I will live saved from death and destruction. So I greet you this morning, my fellow sailors. I greet you. And I tell you all, fair sailing, fair sailing. But Him I salute with different words. All hail, my living captain, for you have guided me away from the gates of hell to the safety of a better shore where fear and death are no more. All hail, my captain, hail.